Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Indian summer kind of night, harvest moon slowly creeping up the sky to hang the light of the sky.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland Angel and Nick Devlin? Y'all like Amy and Nick? Amy and Nick have shared the stage with Billy Joe Shaver, Marsha Ball, and Dale Hawkins. They will release a brand new album, Hang a Light, in early June. They and the band feel it's some of their best work to date. You can find out more at Amy Garland Band on MySpace. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we do a featured artist, and tonight it's Little Rock painter Mara Weir with her painting here entitled Tomatoes. Mara is in the house tonight. Mara's right over here. We love it when the artists are in the house. So you can talk with her after the show about this painting or any of the other pieces that you see. And our listeners can find out more about this painting and Mara at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories center around how things can start off good, but then suddenly and unwittingly take a turn for the worse. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Sam Hedges starts off with good intentions, and it all goes downhill from there. And we'll end the night with Timothy Gentry as one thing leads to another, and he ends up on the hospital floor. But let's start the night with Gary Briggs, a cute girl, and what he thought was a well-hatched plan that quickly disintegrates in Blondes Have More Fun.
It was one evening during summer break when there wasn't much to do in my small town. As usual, the flirtatious Sandra and her sisters were sitting on their front porch while their dad was out of town driving his big rig. Like moths around a nightlight, a group of us teenage boys, including me and my friend Terry, congregated on their front porch. Sandra was in the eighth grade with me and the youngest of the three beautiful blonde sisters. All the guys in the neighborhood were more than just infatuated. In fact, all of us kind of had an idea of a romantic encounter. However, there was one big problem. The girl's dad was a big, mean truck driver. He was left, however, with the undesirable task of raising these three girls after their mom had passed away. And he must have remembered what he was like when he was a teenage boy, so he took his job of protecting the girls very, very seriously. That evening, Sandra seemed much more flirtatious than ever before. She came over close and whispered to Terry and me that she would probably be on her front porch later that night after everyone else had left. And if we wanted to stop by, come on over. And she even said that if for some reason she were not outside, we were to scratch on her bedroom screen window and she would come outside. Then she added, she didn't know for sure if her dad would be home or not. Wow, our wildest dreams are about to come true. How could we turn down such an offer? It was obvious Sandra knew that we were the two coolest guys in the school, and she must be falling madly in love, but we just didn't know which one of us it was madly in love with. So Terry and I had to quickly think of something. How could we both sneak out of our houses and rendezvous at Sandra's house at an hour well beyond our curfew? The only plan we could think of was for Terry to spend the night with me. We would camp out in the backyard. And then, after my parents were sound asleep, we could sneak up the road to Sandra's house. Sounded like a fail-safe plan to us. So around 11 p.m., when our passions were high and we knew my parents were asleep, we did indeed make our way up the street to Sandra's house. Unfortunately, as we got closer, we could see through the moonlight that Sandra was not on the front porch. After about 2 seconds, we decided to go to Plan B. The old scratch on the screen plan, as you recall. Terry and I then realized the chances of getting caught had increased substantially, but the excitement level had also increased. So in the moonlight, we developed a strategy. And that's when we realized we had overlooked one small but very important detail. We forgot to ask Sandra which bedroom window was hers. So regardless of this small oversight, Terry and I decided to take our chances and hope that luck was on our side. So Terry, the plan was that Terry was to crawl around one side of the house and I was to crawl around the other, and we were to look for the open bedroom window. Sounded good to us. But we were extremely concerned that if Sandra's dad had come home, we needed some kind of signal to know to run for our lives. So I was crawling on one side of the house, Terry on the other by the shrubbery. And little did I know that Sandra's older sister had her bedroom window open and she heard something outside, of which she got up to look, and sure enough, she saw me in the dark, screamed at the top of her lungs. And that's when my romantic encounter went to panic, you know. So I got up and ran to the corner of the house. Terry heard her scream. He ran to the opposite corner of the house. He saw me in the dark, and in a loud whisper, he said, "Is it her dad?" The only part I heard him say was, "Her dad." And that was our agreed-upon signal to run for your life. So I took off running like a scared rabbit. Terry saw me running in the moonlight, and he thought he'd better follow. And at this point, I was approximately 4 steps ahead of him, full speed, approaching the 3-foot picket fence behind Sandra's house. We both cleared the fence by a good 5 feet. I only wished I could jump that high during basketball practice. Little did we know that Sandra's old house had a septic tank sewer system that was in dire need of repair. And there was this slimy, stinky sludge you can imagine. We had no idea, and we were running right into the quagmire. So we went from about 40 miles an hour to about zero as we bogged down knee deep. It was not a pretty sight. When the stench of the foul muck, that's when the gagging, well, never mind. Finally, we pulled ourselves out the other side, picked up the pace, and made it back down to my house, jumped into the tent, slimy, yucky, yeah, you can imagine. Unfortunately, Sandra's big sister recognized me in the moonlight, and it took her about 30 seconds to find my parents' phone number in the telephone directory. So she calls. My dad, who was indeed asleep, gets up to answer the phone, only to hear accusations about his peeping Tom son. And my dad used to hardly ever get mad, but this was one of those nights he did. So he comes charging out of the back porch, of course, in his underwear, and to say, "Where have you boys been?" And of course, he didn't think or believe that when I said, "Nowhere, Dad." Just as he was starting toward the tent, he caught the whiff of the smell, and that's when he started gagging. So, you know, I never did find out, really, if my dad ever told Terry's dad or parents about that, because life's not fair, you know, when these things happen. So, but I was the one that suffered the emotional embarrassment as the next day when my dad sat in the driveway while I'm apologizing to Sandra's older sister about, anyway. But what really, really burned my buns, the next day at school, Sandra told all her girlfriends the whole story. She laughed and told them the whole thing was a big joke and she never was going to come out on the front porch. She was just pulling a trick on us. Well, they all looked over at Terry and me and laughed and giggled. Well, my male pride was wounded, you know, male rejection, all those things. So I had to pay her back. So I called all of my buddies over and pointed at her and said, "Guess what? Sandra's stuff does stink. And if you don't believe me, go ask my dad. You know, I never could understand why 4 years later, when I asked Sandra to go to the senior prom, she turned me down.
Gary Briggs is a baby boomer from a small town in Oklahoma. He is a sales director in telecommunications and has called Arkansas home since 1999. Next, Sam Hedges decides to do good and volunteer, but his plans quickly take a turn for the worse in Farming and Love, A Tale of Tragedy.
Several months into my stint as a volunteer farmhand, someone got the bright idea to inject every female animal with hormones and induce a farm-wide breeding season. Not that any self-respecting farmer would call Overlook Farm a farm. It is a learning center in rural New England, owned by Heifer International, and operated by people like me. Out of touch urbanites with do-gooder streaks, but not enough sense to hunker down and become doctors. It's also a working farm with gardens, cattle, goats, sheep, hay barns, tractors, and 20 or so random volunteer farmhands who feel confused the 3 to 12 months of their stay. I was straight out of college, knew almost nothing about farming, and the idea seemed kind of quaint. Some graduates went on to dissertations or law firms. I went off to milk goats and compost my own manure. As a motley crew of underdogs in rural Massachusetts, we volunteers did chores every day, cooked meals together, wiped our miserable cold noses, and survived a farm run amok. And then came the highly regrettable decision to induce a breeding season. Now, having grown up in the city life of Little Rock, I've been sheltered all my life by the humane practice of courtship and romantic etiquette. So I was unprepared for how the rest of the animal world likes to go about love. It started with the males. A chorus of frantic squawks that sounded like a parrot-chimpanzee hybrid. At first, I thought someone may be dying on the farm and wandered over to check it out. Soon, the monkey bird squawks were joined by a dull thud, 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 like a kid jumping on a plywood trampoline. And so I found 6 buck goats shrieking, taking rounds, ramming their heads against every available surface, and urinating on their own beards. Frozen in place with this kind of dumb look, I wondered if such a thing as mad goat disease existed. Another volunteer explained to me that the bucks were in rut, i.e., a horny madness had descended upon them. It was worse than anything a 14-year-old boy has ever had to deal with. Over the 2 preceding months, those bucks managed to break every fence. One even butted through the wall of the barn and was found near the grazing ladies, his head covered in blood. It was insanity. Mating was terrifying. It was like watching the Hulk's carnage in real life. Every time I led a ewe or doe to the breeding pen, I felt like I was an accomplice to a crime. Leaving that stoic lady in the pit of despair, her mate soiling his face and making bizarre tongue gestures. I'd privately whisper an apology as I closed the gate and the buck continued his inexplicable crusade against decency and wood. It made my college frat house seem downright civil. Add this to the pile of misfortune. Before dropping each goat or sheep off in the pit of despair, we had to grab them first. If you've ever been around a flock of sheep, You know that they are terrified of people. The only object on Earth that can overcome their deep fear of humans is grain. Tetra, to be specific, a corn-based grain soaked in molasses. Probably it's the ruminant version of methamphetamine. And it totally reverses the situation. Instead of running away, the animals attempt to swallow you whole. Anyway, just about every day we had to pull a few ladies away from the flock and lead them to their sad, sad fates. A real farmer probably has a fluid and efficient approach to doing this, but we were inexperienced volunteers and thus came up with our own misguided solution. On this particular day, we were practicing the human fence, and this is how the human fence works. We volunteers would make an encircling line connected by our outstretched arms and approach the flock. The sheep would naturally move away and pull together as we steered the whole flock into a corner. Once we reached the corner, with only a few feet between us and the sheep, a massive jailbreak ensued. And as jailbreaks go, it involved chaos and injury on the human side. If all things went well, we managed to grab hold of at least one terrified sheep. The afternoon chores were over, and we had to extricate a Jacob sheep numbered in spray paint as number 42, as in the 42nd victim in what was becoming a breeding spree. Now, Jacob sheep are small and theoretically mild-mannered. In that case, number 42 was the golden exception, a true escape artist among a sea of idiots. We tried the grain, but she managed to get her fix and leap out of our hands every time, and so the 10 of us pulled out the human fence. To spare you a frustrating, repetitive story of failure, I'll give you this simple montage. Envision blooper music played over a scene in which a fence of morons in overalls are dive-bombing into rocks, arms grabbing at nothing, outsmarted by sheep. Over and over, 10 people chasing one sheep. Now imagine watching that for an hour. There were dives and tackles, a lot of cussing, and more than a few wrong sheep were grabbed. There was even one moment in which I gripped number 42 between my legs, but it only took her a few seconds to outwit me. To top it all off, the giant resident camel, Abu, like I said, this was not a real farm. He was also in the pen, hovering agitatedly and scaring the hell out of us. And so I had reached a low point. I was beyond frustrated, entertaining glorious visions of myself doing an Olympic victory lap, holding number 42 over my head, the Chariots of Fire theme song playing. Nothing else mattered except capturing number 42 and proving that I was not a waste of human life. I graduated college. I can catch a sheep. I coached myself. The sun was near setting. The cold was turning bitter. It was my time. We were letting the sheep calm down and forget all about the unassuming group of people who'd been terrorizing them for an hour. It happens a lot faster than you suspect. Operation Human Fence was reactivated, the line rebuilt. I had number 42 clear in my sights. We approached. They began to flock away. We cornered. Even as they bolted over and through our fence, I kept my eye on number 42. Here she came, straight for me. I broke the fence and readied my hands. Our destinies aligned and conspired to collide. As the whites of her eyes came into view, number 42 took a leap on par with the jumping capacity of a Kenyan athlete. She soared from the earth. My moment had arrived, redemption on the cusp of filling my chalice. Number 42 leveled her stone-hard head into my shoulder and delivered me the first ever line tackle of my life. She sent me backwards over myself, glasses flying into the air. My feet temporarily lost contact with the ground as a 30-pound sheep trumped my 140 pounds. The suspended moment took less than a second, but seemed to hang there forever. I landed with a thud on the New England rocky soil, and number 42 landed on me in return, recovering as soon as she left a sheep-sized bruise on my chest. I lay there for a while, imagined lights twinkling above me, thinking over the state of my life, hoping that staying still might somehow erase me from my place on this earth. I recalled that my father once suggested I try out for football. In hindsight, I judge his advice to be misguided. Some time passed. I groped for my glasses, slid them onto my face, quietly got up and left the pen, head down, unburdened of my pride. To my back, the sounds of volunteers throwing themselves at sheep continued. The next morning, I learned that they did eventually catch number 42. Maybe my misfortune bolstered them. They shot her with hormones and lugged her over to the breeding pens. It was only as they were untying the pen door that the livestock manager walked by, and the livestock manager said, "Hey, why are you putting that wether in the breeding pen?" A wether, I learned, is a castrated male sheep. And therefore, really not up for pregnancy. And so, they led the bewildered, estrogen-jacked ram back to his pen. So things went at Overlook Farm. Mulling it over, I'd say that this story of tragedy is really number 42's and not mine. It's one thing to have your inadequacies exposed by a sheep, but it's another to be neutered, chased for an hour, shot full of hormones, and nearly bred with a buck goat. Yet, number 42 prevailed against the odds, one sheep versus a horde, and like a fairy tale, he was saved at the last moment on the edge of peril. I, on the other hand, was spared no scrap or pain of humiliation in the hard, tragic world of farming and love.
Sam Hedges is a 26-year-old Little Rock native who graduated from Sewanee, the University of the South, and spent a year volunteering at Heifer International's Overlook Farm. He returned, not any better at farming, but with some good stories. In our final story of the night, Timothy Gentry's turn downward comes quite literally in Eggs, Bacon, and Baby.
"It's always the A," my wife said. Abruptly drawn out of my double cheeseburger-induced coma, I focus on my wife, and totally ignorant of the subject of this new conversation topic, I ask, "What are we talking about?" "It's always the light in the A that starts flickering first. At Waffle Houses the world over, it's always the A in waffle that burns out first. I wonder if it just can't stand to be wedged in between that majestic W with its four long, graceful limbs, or if the two stunted twins that follow bully it towards darkness." Statements like these have always given me both an appreciation of and a fascination with her distinctly unique mind and a giant migraine for having to think of some reasonable way to respond to them. I soon realize that I'm not going to be allowed to let this statement slide idly by, and I focus all my attention on the woman stuffed into the booth across from me. Now, let me be clear. I only say stuffed because at 8 months pregnant, any woman is stuffed into any booth anywhere. As she continues to prattle on about the philosophical motivations of a glorified light bulb, "Order, 2 eggs, over easy, bacon, hash browns, scattered, covered, chunked, and capped with toast," rips through the air, and my ADHD flares up. I find myself staring over her shoulder at the chef of the establishment, a 300-pound, red-haired man with a balding plate and grease burns all over his massive forearms. He awakens from his daze and suddenly moves with both surprising agility and mesmerizing grace. He prances around the kitchen like a Russian ballerina who has unfortunately been trapped in the body of an overweight Irishman. One drawer flies open and fat fingers nimbly fling four thick pieces of bacon onto the flat iron. One, no, two scoops of hash browns suddenly lie dancing on the griddle. Three lightning-fast jabs into stainless steel hotel pans later, ham, onions, and mushrooms decorate the now golden potatoes. The bottom drops out on a few unsuspecting pieces of bread as they are flung down into the scorching heat of the toaster oven. And finally, he turns his attention to the eggs. The deft skill with which he cracks both eggs with one hand simultaneously and escorts them to the red-hot skillet awaiting their arrival amazes me. After about 40 seconds, he reaches out, grabs the handle of the skillet, and ever so nonchalantly flicks his wrist, sending the eggs up into the air into two perfectly laid out slow-motion backflips. But something goes terribly wrong. Whether it's the new skillet, the late hour, or the improbable mistake, one egg's trajectory starts to separate from the other. A look of surprised shock comes over the cook's face. Instantly, years of experience throw the cook into triage mode, for it had become apparent that both eggs could not be saved. He chooses the one on the right and cradles the chosen egg into a loving embrace on the frying pan, while the other continues its graceful, serene journey, which ends abruptly with a loud splat and a bright yellow liquid oozing towards the dark floor drain. 3 hours later, my wife grabs the remote out of my hand, pauses the TV, and says, "Honey, it's time to go." Excited about the prospect of getting a normal-sized wife back and grumbling about my unborn son's chosen time of arrival, I load the car up with all the required amenities, and we set off towards the hospital. "Well, is the pain as bad as advertised?" I ask as we pull into the hospital parking lot. "No," she says. "I've been trying to tell everyone that I have always had an extremely high pain tolerance. I think we will be able to save money because I won't have to get an epidural." Oh, God! Make it stop! Ouch! Ouch! That one was a little worse than the others. I still think I can handle it, though. As if offended by her stubbornness, chided by her bravery, and summoned by her boasting, her body unleashes a savage assault, and the first real pain rips across her abdomen, and the demands to see the anesthesiologist begin. The approaching dawn finds my wife sweat-soaked, exhausted, terrified, and still harboring a baby inside her. The doctor has been worried that the delivery is not going well for quite some time when the quick, steady whoomp, 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 whoomp that had been beating a steady cadence out of the speaker connected to the fetal heart monitor suddenly stops. A small moment of perfect silence descends upon the delivery room. It dawns on me that my son's heart has just ceased to beat. Then everyone starts screaming at once, like a fire ant hill that has just been poked with a stick. The amount of doctors and nurses present multiply like they are crawling out of the very tiles beneath my feet. Machines, tables, scalpels, nurses appear as if from the air. "Forceps now!" The doctor, who happens to go to church with us, yells over the loud commotion. He calmly says to my wife, "We have to get this baby out of you now. I'm going to try to pull him out while we continue to prepare for surgery." A white masked nurse hands him a glorified pair of salad tongs that look like the ones at Olive Garden. After carefully placing the tongs in position, the doctor begins to pull. I'm expecting a gentle to moderate pull. I'm wrong. Cords of muscle on the ex-quarterback turn to doctor's arms strain. He lifts my wife's pelvis off the table, and nothing else happens. And just as I'm about to point out that retrieving the baby's head disconnected from the rest of it helps us out none whatsoever, an audible pop silences the room. My son's shoulder enters the birth canal, and like a cork shot out of a champagne bottle, out shoots my son. The upward momentum of the tongs send the newborn into a perfectly laid out, slow motion backflip. Time itself freezes. The doctor, appearing to move through molasses, tries to catch him with his now slippery salad tongs and misses completely. Envisioning nothing but yellow yolk, splattered eggs, and floor drinks, I dive for my baby without a moment's thought, just as my wife jerks up quickly to catch him herself. The metal frame from the stirrup crashes down onto my head, knocking me out completely, just as my son lands softly in the cushioned catch pan, which, up until that point, I never knew existed. 18 crazy months pass, and my wife and I find ourselves returning to the same hospital in order to bring our daughter into the world. And as we approach the glass doors, the doctor meets us at the door and escorts us through the receiving and takes us straight up to a private delivery room that I would have expected to see in a downtown hotel. After gingerly helping my wife into bed, he says, "I guess you figured this out by now, but since I threw your son across the room last time, we're going to treat you like the royal family of the hospital." To which I reply, "No, doc, you don't have to do that. You just make sure the next time you audible from a handoff to a pass play that all the intended receivers hear the play call."
Timothy Ty Gentry graduated from Harding University in Searcy, Arkansas, and currently teaches English at Southside High School in Batesville, Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are currently open for submissions from Southerners. For more information, visit talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.